Ouch, the show that confronts that old-fashioned awkwardness around disability. We're back for February. I'm Rob.
And I'm Kate. This month, we meet the man filmed singing to himself whilst listening to music on a London underground train. He didn't know he'd been filmed until it went viral on YouTube. Though commuters may have been laughing, he was actually suffering mental health difficulties. Hear his story later.
It's Oscars time again, and another non-disabled actor is in line to win an award for playing a disabled character. Critics are getting louder about this practice, but is it always wrong?
And towards the end of the hour, it's our quiz and music from an unsigned disabled artist. Stay tuned, folks. It's gonna be a good one.
Ouch! Disability Talk from the BBC with Rob Crossan and Kate Monaghan.
So without further delay, let me introduce you to our guests. We've got four this month and they'll all be here for the whole hour, except maybe Mark Brown from Social Spider, who may be leaving early, and I'm not sure if you want to tell us why you're leaving early. I know. Do you want to share it with the group or would you rather not? Shall I make up an excuse?
No, that's fine. I've got my own excuse. I've got to head off to therapy.
So Mark is going to therapy, so we'll have him for as long as we possibly can. Now, I said he's from Social Spider. Mark works for them. It's a small social enterprise which mostly concentrates on mental health research, training and publishing.
And hello to Alika. Now, I'm going to have to get this right. Alika Ajidi Jeffs.
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah.
Hey, good work. Cake tick for me there. Now, you're the man who went viral on YouTube that we mentioned at the top of the show.
Yep.
February's Time to Talk Day is asking us to talk for 5 minutes about our mental health. So, Alika, why is it good to share with each other?
Mainly because then you do not feel like you're hoarding all this pressure and emotion on yourself. If you're sharing it with someone who genuinely cares or who actually does listen, it just relieves that pressure and that feeling like the weight of the world on your shoulders.
It's just the getting started that's the hardest bit.
It's the hardest bit, definitely.
And we have Simon Start in here as well, a disabled actor and director. You can currently see Simon in Islands. It's a satire about tax havens at London's Bush Theatre. Now, are there enough disabled actors out there? I'm going to get straight to the point then and ask you to be very blunt with me.
No, bluntly no, there's not. Either for, at the moment, is two problems in that one is there are not enough disabled parts in terms of people actually making work in including disabled people. And then there's a chicken and egg situation that drama schools aren't bringing disabled performers through. So we're just beginning to get some traction with mainstream organisations, theatres and indeed the BBC to get disabled actors out there. But actually, when we come to cast, because I've been casting as well, it's very difficult to find young disabled actors. So that's a problem.
It is indeed.
Well, we'll explore that more a little bit later on. And sorry, Kate, jumped in there.
Well, finally, we've got Lawrence Carter-Long on the line from our studio in Washington, D.C. Hello, Lawrence.
Hiya, how's it going?
Good, how are you?
Doing very well, thank you.
Nice. Well, in his day
job... Love that American optimism.
I know.
So good.
So much joy.
It's the caffeine.
That's what we're missing this morning. In his day job, he works for the National Council on Disability. But today he's here in his civilian capacity as arts lover and former curator of the This Disability Film Nights in New York. So, Lawrence, have you seen a lot of disabled films then?
I've seen more disabled films probably than most people on the planet. We did a film series that was monthly, and the idea was to show things that were outside of what people expected. The tagline for This was, no handkerchief necessary, no heroism required.
Nice.
And I once had a reporter from a Hollywood newspaper pause for a moment when I told him that, and he said, well, what do you show then?
Well, what's left after
yes,
that?
Yes, exactly. And I said, exactly that, what you don't expect. Sex, drugs, rock and roll, those are the kind of things that we want to do and that we surprise people with. And what was most miraculous about This was it was a six-month experiment where I was putting these films out there to see if we could get an audience, and it lasted 4 years because they wouldn't let us stop. What that told me is that the audiences were hungry for that. They were looking for depictions of disability that were outside of the cookie-cutter, tragic, heroic monster living on the outside of society.
Though having said this, I am going to ask you later on what the worst ever disability film is. So have a think about that, because I'm going to come to that later. The worst ever portrayal of inspiration or overcoming obstacles. I really want to know because I'm probably going to watch it. Going to the other end of the cinematic spectrum for something that, in my opinion at least, was really rather good. Eddie Redmayne plays the renowned physicist Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything. For those of you who haven't watched it yet, it's the story of the love affair with his first wife, Jane, who married Hawking in the knowledge that his body was deteriorating due to the onset of motor neurone disease. Now, Redmayne's been nominated in the Best Actor category at this year's Oscars, which has led to more column inches than usual, questioning whether it's right that a non-disabled person should ever play a disabled role. So, Lawrence, I'm gonna start with you. I mean, obviously, we know about your credentials of just how many disability films you've watched. What's your take on Eddie Redmayne, an able-bodied actor, playing Stephen Hawking?
Well, I think if there was an award for Best Caricature, he'd get it hands down.
The caricature. This seems rather pejorative.
Yeah, yeah.
Do you intend to be?
And yeah, I do intend it to be because, you know, there are little nervous tics. There are little ways of sitting, little ways of moving, little tricks that actors use that basically say, hey, look at me, I'm showing off, I'm playing a disabled character. I really, really, really want to get that award. And, you know, as we look, you go back through time, whether it was Johnny Belinda or whether it was The Miracle Worker or whether it's, you know, this film now, My Left Foot. A lot of people can perform disability and they put on a big show of it. You know, and I think that that's one of the problems with hiring non-disabled actors to depict disability, to portray disability, is, look, if you're a person of color, you can't take your skin off at the end of the day and just go home. You know, you can't change your gender and just go home. And there's this assumption that you can adopt these physical tics and kind of get disability right, or at least do it in the showy way, do it in a performative way.
What do you mean by putting on a big show?
Putting on a big show. You know, look at me, I'm acting. And you can see this time and time again in the film itself, whether it's there's the scene in Theory of Everything where the woman in the audience, the student, drops the pen. And there's a brief second where we're shown the Stephen Hawking character for just one moment, miraculously cured of ALS, bending down to pick up the pen and hand it to her. We've seen it in films like Diving Bell and the Butterfly. We've seen it in foreign films, art house films like Oasis, where all of a sudden that character who is supposed to be disabled, to show you just how well that actor's doing, miraculously becomes non-disabled and suddenly pulls off this nice little magic trick. Well, and I think that's done to make the audience feel better. It's done so that the audience can say, oh, yes, they're just acting. This is not something that we have to think about.
And it's a dream sequence. It's almost suggesting that the best thing that could possibly happen to Stephen Hawking would be able to walk again, not thrive within his disability.
Or to, despite everything that he had done with his theories, with his accolades, with his awards, what's he thinking about at that moment? Getting up out of the wheelchair, bending down, picking up the pen and handing it up, looking kind of lecherously at the young woman.
Well, let me tell you, when I did watch that film, I would say at least 40% of the audience were in buckets of tears when that happened. But whether that is a mark of good
including
acting or just a mark
Rob?
Of our sentimentality, no, I don't cry. I did cry at Watership Down. That was probably the last. So yeah. Anyway, look, I'm gonna bring Simon into this in a moment. But first of all, we did ask some of our listeners about this. So we're gonna start with Natasha, who's trying to remember which disabled actors she's seen on the telly.
There's the woman in Coronation Street who was with the ginger man. I don't know her name. There is somebody in EastEnders who has a market stall. Don't know her name. There's somebody in, I don't know, but he's got cerebral palsy.
I mean, obviously, if an actor is disabled and capable of doing the part, it's not a problem. But you can't expect people with every disability to be able to play a part, because a lot of disabilities make the people so tired or unable to concentrate or whatever to be actually be able to function.
Identity as a person with a disability is just as important as racial identity. So if we're making that argument against blacking up, the same argument holds against cripping up.
When you see things where people are overly doing the disability, it's like, oh, he's holding a piece of chalk, oh, I can't hold a piece of chalk, oh, it's so annoying, I'm so upset. Or I've knocked over a cup of coffee, oh, I'm so upset. It's because it comes from a place where the person playing it has no knowledge of disability, has no understanding of it. So he can only bring his own terror.
Well, the first comment we got there from Natasha. I'm just going to throw this at you, Simon. I mean, yeah. When I first heard that, I thought, in a way, that's kind of progress, because if she'd been asked that question 10 years ago, I'm not sure she would have been able to think of anybody in a mainstream soap opera, for example, who was disabled. And admittedly, Natasha couldn't remember any of the names, yeah. But she was aware of it. Now, does this, am I being overly optimistic by saying that's progress, or do you want to slap me down for
progress.
Saying that?
I think there has been progress. I mean, I trained as an actor 20 years ago, and I auditioned for drama schools. And one of them said, if you weren't disabled, we'd definitely let you in. These were the good old days when they could be blatant about it. Another drama school said, we'll let you in as long, if you can get cured.
So, cured.
Wow. And then another one happily let me in. Yeah, I mean, you know, I don't. What were they thinking? I've no idea. But and then finally, another drama school, the Welsh College, let me in, and I had no problems at all, and it was a great training. So it's kind of the assumptions of what makes an actor are changing, I think, a lot. There have been things within television, kind of positive action schemes within the BBC, of which I was on one of them, and that brought in, indeed, Lisa Hammond on EastEnders. I mean, Lisa's been an actress for a long time, since she was in Grange Hill, but she got the role in EastEnders by the casting directors being reminded by that scheme that Lisa existed, and they invited her in.
So how do disabled actors get into acting then? Is it through drama school, and are all disabled people going down the same route? I mean, obviously you've had a bad experience at drama school, but are they getting better? Are there more places for people now?
I can only talk about anecdotal evidence. I've seen some actors come through drama school who are disabled in a way, it was mildly disabled in a way that I mean, if you saw me now, I'm kind of got a slightly clenched body, and I can get away with being odd in able-bodied parlance, but that's kind of useful as an actor to be, to present that surface. If you more severe disabilities, when drama schools are not in any way set up to cope with that. Grey Eye, a few years ago, had a missing piece training scheme.
And Grey Eye's a theatre company.
Yeah, Grey Eye, theatre company, who specialise in disabled work. And they had a training scheme along. We worked with, I think it was London Met University, to train some actors, and that brought a whole tranche of disabled actors in. But that's gone now, and there isn't really anything happening. There's occasional actors drip through, but nothing in terms of them now, as television starts to say, oh, we want diversity on screens.
And this is
difficult.
There's so many Best Actor and Actress or Oscars going to people who play disabled characters rather than, obviously, disabled people playing disabled characters. I mean, and this is an astonishing potential DVD marathon. So we've got, let's go back here. This is really incredible. Dustin Hoffman in Rain Man.
Daniel Day-Lewis in My Left Foot.
Al Pacino in Scent of a Woman.
Holly Hunter, The Piano.
Tom Hanks in Forrest Gump.
Jeffrey Rush in Shine.
Jack Nicholson in As Good As It Gets.
Hilary Swank, Million Dollar Baby.
Jamie Foxx in Ray.
Colin Firth, The King's Speech.
And most recently, Jennifer Lawrence in The Silver Linings Playbook. I mean, that is an incredible list of able-bodied actors playing disabled characters and winning an Oscar. So, Mark, I'm going to bring you in. Is it different with mental illness? You know, should we expect those roles to go to actors who have mental health too, you know, such as Beautiful Mind, Silver Linings Playbook, movies like that?
I mean, I think there's a kind of, there's an interesting thing that happens with this, which is that all the stories that you talk about are very much stories about disabled people. They're not disabled people's stories. And there's something about the way narrative works, the way the film industry works, the way stage works, that wants to tell exciting, brilliant stories for their audience. And generally speaking, disabled people's actual real experience isn't what people feel the audience is looking for. So the question is, as a disabled writer or a disabled actor, what story would you choose to tell? It's probably not going to be A Beautiful Mind, etc., etc. In terms of mental health, it's kind of weird because I don't think mental health's kind of got to the point of self-definition that the broader disability world's got to. In that I don't think people with mental health difficulties would ever stand up and make a fuss about those sort of things. We're still at the sort of very beginning of coming out of the shadows, if you like. Mm. So we're like, oh, wow, it's amazing. There's a character who's got bipolar and they're on EastEnders, rather than thinking, actually, I don't know if there's any actors who've got direct experience of severe mental health difficulties out there. And if there are, I don't know whether those experiences in any way influence either the parts that they take or their performance in roles. So I think we're kind of still at the sort of mousy stage. We're going, oh, it's brilliant, someone mentioned
we
depression.
Sort of consider it an event, don't we?
We're
disabled actor.
Party poppers, etc., etc., especially around mental health.
You're listening to Ouch, the monthly disability talk show from the BBC in London with Rob and Kate. Round the table, we have Lawrence Carter-Long, Simon Starton, Alika Agidi-Jeffs and Mark Brown. Lawrence, I want to come back to you now. You say you've seen the most films about disability ever possible in the whole wide world.
I want that in an encyclopedia somewhere. In addition to this, I curated and co-hosted a history of disability in film for Turner Classic Movies. And I watched 237 films to narrow that down to 20 that we were able to screen. And we did films from the silent era up through when a law here in the States called the Americans with Disabilities Act was passed in 1990.
Did you have to pan any of them?
I did. I mean, if you're going to do a history of disability in film, I think you've got to show the good, the bad, and the ugly. I think you've got to show the types of films that were made, why they were important for that time, why they were significant for that time, why they got the award. And maybe then, you know, in hindsight, with 20, 30 years between you, why that film might be problematic today, why they could have gotten away with something in 1932 that it wouldn't probably pass today, that audiences would rise up against it and speak out against it.
I'm presuming you watched some stuff which were just staggeringly offensive by today's standards.
Mind-blowingly. I mean, it was the kind of thing where you'd be, how did that ever... And I think it goes back to what you were talking about earlier, that these audiences, these films aren't really made with disabled audiences in mind. They're made for non-disabled audiences in mind. They're not written by disabled people. They're not directed by disabled people. They're not produced by disabled people. Very rarely do they have disabled people in them. If you look at, you're talking about award season right now, you look at the history of the Academy Awards, how many disabled actors have gotten Academy Awards? I can pick out two. Harold Russell, 1946, and Marley Matlin with Children of a Lesser God. You know, that's a long time if you've gotten 100 years of movies. Sure. And you've got two actors that you can pull.
So what kind of cliches are we seeing in these kinds of films then?
Well, they often varied by era. So, you know, you would often have in the silent era, you'd have the outcast, the monster, you know, the Phantom of the Opera, the Hunchback of Notre Dame, you know, sort of, Lon Chaney was called Man of a Thousand Faces. He could have been called Man of a Thousand Disabilities. If you look at the types of films that he made, some of them were sympathetic, some of them were not, you know, but I think Chaney, you know, as an actor, he had deaf parents. And so doing silent films, I think he was able to bring, you know, an expression that a lot of actors didn't have that sort of informed the roles. From there, you got the tropes that we're all familiar with, the tragic disabled person, where the violins are playing in the background, films like An Affair to Remember, where someone is tragically stricken with a disability and then feels that they have to hide it from the rest of the world. And then, of course, the flip side of the tragedy is the triumph, right? The disabled person who cheerily overcomes that disability to the rocky music in the background and is able to fulfill all their dreams and be an inspiration to everyone who's watching.
I assume that's your favourite kind of film there then, Simon, the inspirational one?
Oh, yeah, inspiration porn, I call it. It's kind of the sort of, Lawrence said, about the actors doing tics and disability as a performance. From my point of view as an actor, it's the lowest form of acting. It's external, it's kind of putting on a mask, but people like to see acting. They like to see the display of acting, even if it wasn't about disability, about something else. They like to see that thing. And I, as an actor, perhaps would like to do some performance where I was displaying my technicality and get a lot of kudos and a lot of ego fluffing from that. But the true great acting performance comes from a degree of empathy and a degree of allowing your emotions and your emotional memory to come through whatever body you have, whatever physical manifestation you particularly have been sewn up with, and allow that to communicate a story. And that, for me, is what great acting is about. And when an able-bodied actor starts to perform disability, they just, I mean, they will have some empathy involved in it, but they won't have the genuine, authentic experience to draw on. And that's where I draw a line on it, really, is that block.
And Alika, let me throw this over to you.
Yeah.
People have said that cripping up as the term goes, is the same as blacking up was, you know, many years ago. Which do you think is more offensive, or are they equally as offensive? Would you rather see a white person blacking up to play a black role, or a sort of person without a disability cripping up to play a disabled role?
I think the metaphor or the simile is very, very strong to use at first. That's the first thing. I think it's a very extreme metaphor to use to describe what's going on. But it opens up a can of worms. I think ultimately, speaking for myself, I can't really speak for anyone else, I guess. But speaking for myself, when I first heard that, I thought, well, that's quite an extreme dynamic to use to describe what's going on here. But I think when you think, looking at the situation, people will definitely look at it and go, if you have disabled people playing the disabled roles, then wouldn't that mean it's not acting? That's what a lot of people would definitely start to say. And so bringing it back to the whole, like, cripping up as opposed to or being the same as people blacking up, I think it's a thing where whoever invented that extreme analogy to use, they need to then look at the fact of when someone was blacking up in the past to play a black role, you could blatantly still tell that they were not black, right?
Mm.
So isn't it the same thing if someone is cripping up to play a crippled role? You could still blatantly tell, especially by what Lawrence was saying earlier on, where you get those moments in a film where unnecessarily just to show off and show you that, hey, look, I'm still good, I'm still this actor. You can still blatantly tell that it's not genuine, it's not real. So it's down to if you can honestly say you'll prefer to be lied to and sold a dream on your imagination, or if you want something that is real and hard hitting and will make you feel that it was genuine.
Simon, it's sometimes okay, though, isn't it, for a non-disabled person to play a disabled role?
Well, it has to be taken with judgment. Maybe sometimes it is. I would say perhaps there are some times when a disabled role can't be played. Maybe Mr. Redmayne might fall into that. You can argue that because that is a story of someone who starts off able-bodied and becomes disabled. So to tell that story, maybe you would have to play able-bodied unless you were going to the extent of having a budget of CGI or something like that.
Well, I want to test this to see just how far we can go before we're either comfortable or uncomfortable with it. So we've got Bradley Cooper, who's been playing Joseph Merrick, the Elephant Man on Broadway, and that's coming to London's West End next month. Is it okay for him to play a severely disfigured man, Lawrence?
Well, I think that's a good question. I would say that if he's taking opportunities away from disabled actors, if seeing Bradley Cooper get that role is you know, taking food out of the mouths of people that could do so otherwise, who never got the opportunity to audition, then we have to question it. I think you're really hitting the nail on the head here, though, in terms of what the differences are. My friend Christine Bruno at Inclusion in the Arts in New York City talks about how disability is seen as a technical skill in the industry. And this is what I think separates it from blackface or redface or yellowface or any of these other things. Most people don't see disability as a culture. They don't see disabled folks as a community. They see it as something that you can put on and you can take off. They see it as something that's performative. You know, most of the stories that were done when I've done my various film projects has always been the disabled person sort of on the outside, going it alone. There's never been groups of disabled people appearing together on the Ouch podcast to deconstruct this. You know, those are the stories you don't see. And I think as long as we don't see those stories, people will continue to not think about disability as something that's an identity, something that's a culture, something that brings a community together. And until the world understands that, it's going to continue to be a problem.
And there may have been a time decades and decades ago where the notion of blacking up was considered a technical skill. Obviously, that's unacceptable now, but yet we're still talking in those frames of reference in disability, aren't we?
Yeah, I think that's exactly what we're doing. And you can, if you look at that list of awards that you rattled off just a little bit earlier, that seems to be the proof, too. I mean, people get accolades. People get awards. People get, you know, prime roles after they've portrayed the disabled person. You're not going to get the same thing if you try to take on an ethnic identity.
Well, everyone is going to stay with us around the table. Our very male-dominated table today. I am the only female here, which I think is a good thing. That's okay, isn't it? Rob?
Yeah. I had, you know, I'm so politically correct, I hadn't even noticed.
Well, coming up, we have got some music for you. That's Winter Winds by Hemingway, this month's unsigned disabled artist, and you can hear that in full at the end of the show. Now, how often do you talk about your mental health, Robert?
What do you define it? I think I was reading a bit about mindfulness the other day, and I'm really suspicious of it, if I'm perfectly honest. I don't think that, you know, staring at your app, which tells you to yourself for 4 minutes a day, that is mindfulness. That's what they're saying it is.
No,
that's a mindfulness
app. That's not talking about it. Just complaining about an app that just because you don't get on with it.
I'm just trying to deflect the issue.
Other than saying that you're in a bad mood, how often would you say you actually talked about your mental health?
I would say actually quite regularly since becoming an adult, and particularly having been married and gone through a divorce and having to deal with my own deteriorating vision.
Gosh.
It's got a bit. But you see, you're bored. I bored myself about 10 seconds ago.
Sorry, I mean, let's explore further these issues that you're.
What is it in the psychiatrist's chair?
It's suddenly taken a turn. I didn't expect. No. Everybody, I do apologise.
Yeah, you were expecting. Well, I tried to give you a nonsense answer, and you,
you
kept
did.
Pushing
it's
me.
My
and
own
now you're getting
fault.
The truth.
I'm
yeah,
sorry,
you're no
I'm
one to blame
sorry.
But yourself there. I would like to think as an adult male who finds this quite hard, I have succeeded somewhat in becoming better over the years. What about you?
Well, I have therapy twice a week for 50 minutes, so I talk there. I'm married to a girl, so all we do is talk about our feelings, you know, it's part of being a lesbian. sometimes more than others, sometimes it invades work and I have to talk about it at work, but I still find it embarrassing and still find it, you know, a difficult thing to do.
It comes
back
to the confidence then, really.
Exactly. Like,
that's
you have
even
to have
how
confidence.
I started music, through that confidence issue.
Well, so. We're all being urged to take 5 minutes out to discuss mental health on this year's Time to Talk Day, brought to you by Rethink and Mind. Now, we just heard from you. That's Alika Agidi Jeffs. Yeah. Agidi Jeffs. Yeah. Sorry.
Did you just correct him on how to pronounce his own name?
No, he corrected me.
Oh, right, fine. Okay, sorry.
You kind of did that at the same time.
Now, you were captured on a video plugged into your headphones, singing a Rihanna song in 2012. As is the way nowadays, it was posted to the YouTube and it became a massive viral hit. Yeah. It went viral for a second time in 2014, thanks to media attention, and has clocked up over 2.5 million hits to date. That is crazy.
Totally.
Now, recently you've put your side of the story, making it known that you were trying to block out the world due to mental distress that you were feeling at the time. Yeah. Now, this is totally up to you. How do you feel if we play a clip of you singing on the tube? Totally your choice?
Yeah, no, I'm cool.
You sure?
Yeah.
Okay, well, let's hear Alika in his now viral video singing on the tube.
And don't tell you, you don't care. It feels true. I know you've been hurt by someone.
So how does it feel listening to that back?
Wow. It just feels... It feels like progress to be able to own it and to be able to hear that and know that, yeah, that was myself and that was then and that was where I was. But it also feels really... also feels a bit strange because I'm hearing it and I can tell that what I can remember the type of things that were going through my mind at the time.
What was going through your mind at the time?
At the time, I was actually pretty much there, like I said, trying to block out the world. I'd finished a performance in my college. College was coming to an end. There was a lot of stress about getting a job, and there was a lot of stress about pretty much like my next steps in life, and then a lot of the other things that were going on. by the time I got to the train station, I had already felt like, okay, I've just come out of a high and now I can feel myself going back to a low. Then I go on the train filled with people that have very dreary and miserable looking faces. They've come back from a hard day at work and I'm like, okay, I am already ready to like totally sink. I need to block that out.
Did you know that you had mental health issues?
No, not at all. I didn't even know what psychosis was. I didn't know about mindfulness. I didn't know about any of this stuff. I had just pretty much been taught the type of typical thing as a man, like, get on with it, don't moan, like, don't complain, just deal with it and be strong and, like, don't give the world your worries.
And I heard that the night before you were feeling incredibly low and you were doing some praying. Can you tell me a bit about that? It wasn't the night before.
It was that same night, literally. So I got in maybe, like, 10:30, said hi to the family. By 11 at night, I remember going into my room, just turned off the lights and just started praying. And I didn't get up until after 12 a.m. I remember it was like an hour long. I was praying to the point where I got up, my knees hurt, and I literally asked for a sign. I said that basically I'm ready to go. I just ready to live this life. Can you just give me any sign whatsoever?
So you were thinking of suicide?
Yeah, like, can you just give me a sign whatsoever that I'm being heard or that there's something worth living for? Then that's
and when, then it appeared on YouTube. And how did you find out that it was on YouTube?
Just loads of people telling me on WhatsApp and Twitter. Those are the two main things, really. Twitter and WhatsApp. We're getting very much bombarded with people going, yo, is this you? Oh my God, I think this is you. Oh my God, it really is you.
And how did it feel when you were getting those messages and then when you saw yourself?
It was three stages. I said I didn't want to hear it first, so I tried to pretend like it doesn't exist, and I tried to pretend like, oh, it's going to fade away, I don't care. Then I had to embrace it, so I tried to then use it as a good thing, like, yay, that is me, and look, it's going viral. I tried to pretend like even to the point where I had to lie to friends and be like, oh, because you don't want to be looked at as weird and anything. So I had to pretend like, yeah, we planned it. It was a spoof movie. Like, we knew what we were doing. Like, and then I had to then finally come to the point where it was hitting home and it was definitely hurtful. Like, some of the comments that were coming in, the amount of abuse I was getting, the backbiting, and friends all of a sudden now basically joining sides with the rest of the world, pointing fingers like, he's an idiot. That's when it really got me.
So people were laughing at you, and how did that make you feel?
Just like anyone else, when you get laughed at first, it's a little bit of embarrassment, and then it's very hurtful. Like, for me, the main thing is when it came from people who I care about, people who I wouldn't expect to do that, but they also didn't know what I was going through. So that's when it really hit home and it really started hurting a lot.
And I know for time to talk that you're here to talk about your recoveries. I mean, how did you start to get better? You know, how are you now?
To be honest, I say it all the time that one of the main things that got me through, as much as NHS helped, I really appreciate their staff at Leo Ward. I really believe the first thing that got me through was prayer, as much as it sounds crazy. Like, for me, praying definitely helped. Reading definitely helped. A change of environment definitely helped. If I was still in my room, I don't think it would have been the same. And fourth would be, I guess, save the best till last. It would be talking with my family, talking with my mum, and talking with, I believe there was specifically a woman called Nushra and a doctor, Dr. Taylor. Those two people at the NHS Leo Ward helped ridiculously. Like, they went above and beyond what they had to. They were questioning me about things that I believe were very much helping me understand how I got to this state of mind so that I can make sense of it all.
Well, it's fantastic to hear that you're doing so well. And we know you've put a video together for Rethink Mental Illness,
yeah.
And we've got links to that from our blog. Now, Mark from Social Spider, I know you're something of a specialist in these things. Is it common for people to have chunks of their lives filmed and uploaded to video sharing sites? Does this happen?
Well, it happens all the time, yeah. Doesn't it? You know, our etiquette for the use of technology hasn't sort of caught up with the technology that we've got. Though, to be honest, you might have been in Victorian times, sat on the omnibus on the way to Clapham, and someone could have been sketching you and going, oh, here's a mental person being mental on the omnibus.
Does anyone ever know what your rights are if you're caught like that and you say, I don't want this to be on...
Your image doesn't belong to you. It belongs to the person who took the image, same as any recording of you belongs to the person who took the recording. But I think the interesting thing for me is, if we're talking about mental health, sort of one of the big things that we talk about in mental health a lot is the idea of stigma. and kind of stigma. People think about it as, you know, the way that we fight stigma is what we need to do is be nicer to people with mental health difficulties, which kind of ignores what's really going on with stigma. And one of the big elements of stigma is shame. Mm. The reason stigmas exist is society decides that some things are unacceptable, and the best way to get people to stop doing them is to make them feel shameful. So you kind of say, this is beyond the pale, you're not meant to do it. And sort of, I think the thing that happened to you there was very much about kind of humour crossing over with shaming. It's kind of, this is funny because it's embarrassing that this guy was singing on the tube. We're uncomfortable with the idea that someone would sing on the tube. Therefore, what we're kind of do is we'll have a laugh, but we're also going to kind of shame him.
And
that's kind of really hard to escape from, because a lot of the time, if you experience a mental health difficulty, you end up doing sometimes things that you kind of wish you hadn't.
And when you do start deconstructing moments like what you went through, Alika, it does actually, when you start picking it apart and looking at the sociology behind it, it actually says a lot more negative things about the audience than it does about the person being filmed, doesn't it? So, but awareness and being nice, clearly, Mark, isn't enough.
No.
Yeah, I think we're at a sort of interesting place with mental health at the minute. We're in what you might call the time to change moment, time to change at the organisers of Time to Talk Day. And it's undeniable that over the past, since 2007 when they started, mental health has sort of really risen up in prominence in terms of public discussion and stuff like that. But there's a kind of challenge or a problem in that a lot of the time, what we need is people with mental health difficulties. You know, I have a mental health difficulty, so I'm allowed to say we. And what we need is kind of changes to the way society works, as much as we need people to be just nicer to us. Mm. Because there's a sort of problem or a challenge around things like Time to Talk Day, and that Time to Talk Day is kind of targeted at people having their first ever conversation about mental health. The problem is that if you've got a mental health difficulty, you might have spent, you know, 20, 30, 40 years talking about mental health. So what is kind of a very long-lived experience for you is kind of an exciting and kind thing that someone's doing for 5 minutes on your behalf.
Mm.
And there's a kind of big mismatch there between what, you know, those of us who are kind of more embedded in the world of mental health might be pitching for in terms of political change, social change, changes to policy, and what someone feels would be the correct thing to do, which is go, oh, it's fine, you're allowed to be mental, it's fine. And you go, actually, you're not really kind of changing that much, because what you're suggesting is all we need to do is kind of be a bit nicer.
Well, what kind of action do you want to see happening other than, you know, say we've got the awareness, what action do we need taking?
It depends. It depends on who you ask. And so the problem is we can't really have that discussion if what we're always being drawn back to is normal. Could you stop making this conversation complicated? We were all kind of very comfortable when we were saying, actually, what we need to do is just be nicer to people with mental health difficulties. And, like, you know, if they go a bit mental, we go, oh, it's all right. They're people with mental health difficulties. It happens. Rather than thinking about the underlying social and economic structures that disadvantage people with mental health difficulties, you know. So basically, I think mental health for me needs to go through its social model of disability point and begin to have that kind of political understanding of where people with mental health difficulties are disadvantaged.
What does that actually mean, the social model of disability for mental health? What does that mean?
Well, people with mental health difficulties, we are by definition neuroatypical. So there's some things that people with depression might commonly experience. Some of those things are really problematic on an individual level. Some of those things are really problematic in terms of where they cross over with the rest of the world. So basically, if you have a condition that makes it really difficult for you to sleep at night, that's fine if you've got nothing to do the next day. But generally, if you want to do a job, people really want you to be a certain place at a certain time.
Yeah.
And if it turns out you're really good at that job, but the one thing that you can't do is get there at 8 o'clock in the morning, or the one thing you can't do is work shifts. If that was a physical disability, people would say, actually, there's a reasonable adjustment to be made here. Mental health is still a kind of grey area. People go, well, how do you know people aren't putting it on? How do you know people aren't swinging the leads?
Well, yeah, we're only about 100... Sorry, Lawrence, say that again.
I was just going to say it's not something that is visible, right? It's not something that's quite as tangible as if you have a white stick, a white cane, or if you use a wheelchair. I think, you know, when I'm not doing talking about movies, I do public affairs and public awareness. That's what brought me into doing disability work. And I think the importance of campaigns like Time to Talk is not only about being nice to people, but I think it gives us an opportunity to be honest about those things that we face. You know, it's to go back to Hollywood again. You know, we've seen, there have been a few actors. Margot Kidder, who was in the Christopher Reeve Superman movies, Catherine Zeta-Jones, Carrie Fisher, have all come out as having mental health issues. And we've seen public awareness campaigns rise out of that. We've seen conversations rise out of that. So I think being nice is the first part. I think having the conversation is the first part. What that can allow us an opportunity to do is to get down to the reality of what life is like. Find community, find other people who have been going through the same sorts of things that we've been going through. I think one of the biggest problems with mental health is, and the stigma, is the isolation that people encounter, that they don't come across other people that have dealt with these issues, that know how to navigate those waters and how to you know that there's going to be light at the end of the tunnel and a different mood at the end of the day. And I think we need more of that, and that's what these kind of campaigns do. They can start it, but it's up to us to bring it forward.
And I'm just going to bring Mark in very quickly, because I know Mark's got to dash off.
I have to dash off to therapy.
Go and talk about your mental health.
I spend all of my time talking about mental health, so it's kind of a special day for it's not that exciting for me. But
very quickly before you go, we're at 100 days away from a general election. Yeah. All the main political parties have been talking about mental health and pledged action. What's happening here? I mean, are you taking all that seriously, or do you think it's?
I wrote something about this the other week, and I described the Liberal Democrats' sort of policy announcements around mental health as being a wonderful and absolutely fantastic cynical, uncynical move, because we're getting to a point where there's more people than ever will look at doing something about mental health as being a good thing. If you do something about mental health, you're one of the good guys. Mm. And that's kind of pretty inarguable now. So the Lib Dems have to differentiate themselves from their coalition partners, who they would like very much to paint as the bad guys. So they're looking for some very sort of clear ground that isn't sort of contentious, where they can say, look what we've done, look what we've brought into being that's completely different from our coalition partners. And mental health's the thing that they focused on. It's fantastic in that people are focusing on mental health. Is it cynical? Yes, it's cynical, but all of politics is cynical and pragmatic.
Well, it's going to be interesting to see how much mental health gets brought up on the televised debates, which are going to be coming up.
I would say absolutely not at all.
Not a bar.
I'll bet you £5 that mental health will not be mentioned.
I'm going to take that bet, because I might phone in with a special question and
that's
make sure
cheating.
It is.
That's cheating.
But I'd take that bet. I think mental health will be something that needs to be covered. And like you say, it could be an easy win for a party leader to bring up.
Right. I've unfortunately got to Peg it across London.
We are going to say goodbye. Thank you so much, Mark.
So
Mark has to head off, but Alika and Simon and Lawrence will be staying with us for our quiz of this month's disability news. You're listening to Ouch, and if you want to get in touch, well, let me count the ways. You can email us ouch@bbc.co.uk, you can tweet us @bbcouch, and you can find us on Facebook. We're everywhere. Kate, would you like to fire us off straight away with the first question?
I certainly would. So, question number one, are we all ready?
Oh, yes.
Well, let's go.
I didn't get told about this. All right, let's do it.
This has been sprung on Alika, so, you know, let's keep our fingers crossed for him. I think Lawrence might do well at this one, but let's see. How has a disabled pensioner profited from getting mugged?
220,000 from absolute strangers.
Oh, hello, Alika.
Yeah, so-called didn't know about the quiz. Straight in there. Absolutely correct. Kate's got the details.
Right first time. 67-year-old Alan Barnes from Gateshead was pushed to the ground whilst putting the bins out in front of his house. It's a horrible thing to happen. It broke his collarbone, and he's visually impaired and 4.5 feet tall and has felt too vulnerable to return to his home and is now staying with his sister. But on hearing of the attack, a local beautician, Kate Cutler, set up a donations page on the web, and at the time of recording, people have given a staggering, over what Alika last saw, £300,000.
Wow.
Barnes is obviously overwhelmed and has sought financial advice, but we assume he can now move to a better home in a safer area.
That's an astonishing story.
Are they going to take him off benefits now because he's been given that money?
Oh.
Does it work like that?
Are Ito's going to come looking for him? I mean, what's going to happen?
Oh, well, that's sad times.
Yeah, well.
So the next question. Why is Manchester's Legoland Discovery Centre receiving criticism from the mother of a young man with a learning disability? Simon, any ideas?
Absolutely no idea.
No idea. Yeah. Lawrence?
No idea.
Has news about Legoland not reached Washington?
It has not reached the States, sadly.
But I think Alika might have another idea.
I do not know. I'm having beginner's luck like crazy right now. But I know it's something to do with... It's a boy, right? So it's a mother's son.
Yep.
Like, having... Like, his needs weren't met in regards to either a toy and not... Either that or in regards to some, like, an experience that he's meant to enjoy.
You're getting so close. You're getting so close. Half a point. Basically, he doesn't need any points. All right,
the lead is essentially unassailable now. Really.
Well, thanks to Simon, we're going to take the point away.
Thanks, Simon.
Who was in?
Well, according to the BBC News website, 20-year-old Anthony Lewis, who has Williams syndrome, which is a learning disability, was denied access on the 19th of January due to the venue's no adults without a child policy. Legoland said the centres were aimed at children between 3 and 10. And Anthony's mother says, "I think this is very poor. Young adults with learning disabilities are really just children in adults' bodies." Lawrence, what do you think about that?
Oh, we need to step out of 1952.
Well, yeah, I think it would be interesting to know what campaigners for the Stay Out Late campaign and trying to get young adults.
Did 20-year-old Anthony Lewis actually want to go to Legoland in the first place? He might have wanted to go clubbing.
This is his mum that's saying that, so, you know, you'd imagine that she knows better than anyone else.
Yeah, but my mum would maybe anticipate that I would want to go to Legoland. So, you know, how many times do we have these conversations with our parents, or do we want our parents making those kind of decisions?
I know, but
20,
my parents
30,
would
40.
Assume I wanted to go to Legoland, and
they'd
be right.
Yeah, but you actually would.
They'd be
actually,
right. I love Legoland. Right. Yeah. I'm worried about this story, mainly because I like going to the Legoland Discovery Centre in Manchester by myself anyway, because it's really fun.
I actually didn't know that you're not allowed to enter the resort without a child. And also, I think until
we... You can at the main theme parks. Theme parks are fine, but not the Discovery Centres.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Yeah. Well, I think that's an opportunity to, discuss the policy, right? Reconsider the policy.
The nomenclature of Legoland, as baffling as it is dull for someone like me. But anyway, we're now, I'm afraid, in dead rubber territory, my friends, because the final question, Alika cannot lose. So it's essentially pointless, but it's another missing headline.
His name's Alika.
Alika,
Rob,
I'm so
really
sorry.
You need to sort this out.
Yes, I do. What's the missing word in this headline? Two-legged puppy mistaken for a... Anybody?
Simon, any ideas?
Get flamingo. I've no idea.
Flamingo, you're actually not close. Far off. It is another animal. Yeah.
Lawrence, any ideas?
Prairie dog.
No.
Two-legged puppy mistaken for.
Go on.
I'm going to be wrong. A baby?
Go on, say it. A baby.
I would not be surprised in this day and age if they mistook a pup for a baby.
It's a great answer, but to paraphrase Roy Walker, it's good, but it's not right. The two-legged puppy was mistaken for...
Lauren.
He said... Shots fired.
The two-legged puppy was, in fact, mistaken for a... kangaroo. It's the story about a puppy adopted by a Northumberland couple, and the BBC website reports 5-month-year-old Roo, you can probably tell the marsupial gender or species by the name, can't you? Roo is thought to have been born with one front leg missing and lost the other soon after birth, which makes it sound like she sort of misplaced it behind a radiator. Roo's owner, Nikki Dick, said people do a double take when they see her hopping about because they think she's a kangaroo. There we go.
For anyone who doesn't know who Matt Fraser is, he is a who Lawrence just insulted. He is a actor who used to present this podcast, who has very short arms,
and now appearing on American Horror Story Freak Show.
He is. He's a Hollywood superstar, really, isn't he?
Yeah. And Matt would laugh at that louder than you did.
So yes, he would. It's very true. There's no worries about that here. Anyway, well, that's it for this month. Ouch is back from the first week of March. We're on the BBC News website. We're available via podcast. And listeners in Canada have recently joined us on AMI Audio. Hello to you. We'd love to hear your comments and ideas for future shows. Email ouch@bbc.co.uk. Or find us on social media via our blog, bbc.co.uk/ouch.
I've always thought we should give out a postal address, just in case, at some point. But sadly, I don't know what it is. Maybe we'll do that next month. Thanks to the team, Kathleen Hawkins, Emma Tracy, and studio manager Simon Hancock. The producer, as always, was Damon Rose.
Are you wanting the name of that movie before we go?
What, the worst movie ever?
The worst movie
yeah,
ever.
Yeah, you can't trail it.
Is it,
not
is it worse than the video for Hello by Lionel Richie?
It's close.
Okay,
it's
go on.
It's close. If you want every cliche that you've ever seen surrounding disability wrapped into one film,
okay.
You can't do any worse or any better than a film called Quid Pro Quo from 2008.
It's a recent one, okay.
Yeah, it's where a wheelchair user who's a journalist starts investigating an underground group of wannabes. That's all I'll say.
Oh my gosh, I'm gonna
have you seen
find
it, Simon?
That tonight.
I have not seen that, but I'm gonna look it up Simon on Netflix it? Immediately or any other broadcast media.
Well, thank you to Lawrence for that. We would have forgotten that if it wasn't for you. We're very grateful. But now it's time.
I shouldn't suffer alone. That's 120. That's an hour and 22 minutes. I'll never get
of
back.
Pure so pain. Quid pro quo.
I'm happy to put it out there.
Well, our band this month is Hemingway, a 5-piece indie group from Norwich in the east of England. So, what's the disability connection? I hear you ask. Well, lead singer Chris Brennan lost his right hand in an accident 3 years ago.
And their music has been compared to The National, Suede, The Cure and early U2. But despite that, BBC Introducing says, watch them now, you'll only regret it when you have to pay £20 for a ticket.
You can see them live at the Hunters Club in Bury St Edmunds on the 27th of February. In the meantime, here's a track from their most recent EP, Real Love. It's called Winter Winds. Goodbye.
Your
winter winds turn the thunder, the lightning blinds my eyes. I just wanted to feel the hurricane every time.